everybody, and welcome again to Spaghetti Code. Hi, Ale. Today we are here with Marco Lenzo, which is a lead architect and a content creator on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel talk about software, DevOps, security, architecture, obviously. Marco likes to define himself as someone that likes software. Hi, Marco, and welcome to Spaghetti Code.
Hi, Marco. Hi, Ale. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure. I have to say I'm excited because this was something that I always wanted to do. Never managed to plan it. And you came to me, you know, you offered me the opportunity. So I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, Marco, as we discussed already before starting the episode, I think you have an advantage over us because you do videos. So you have to be much more careful and deliberate when recording, and people can see you. I think a podcast is much easier from that point of view. So I'm sure you'll be just fine today. But maybe let's give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our audience first, and then we can get deeper into the topic of this new episode today.
Yes, I mean, I like to keep it simple. As Marco said, I'm someone who loves software. And I started when I was a teenager, literally in my room. And then I had the opportunity of growing professionally. So I started as a software engineer. And I think I was lucky. I joined a team where there were a lot of good role models, mentors, people I would look up to. And that's what eventually took me, you know, to become a team lead and later an architect, right? But over the course of my career, whatever the role I had, literally the common denominator is that I like software and everything that, you know, rotates, you know, or exists around it. You know, so even concepts like leadership and agile, I find them very interesting. Obviously, when I started as an engineer, it was all about programming, but then the more you grow in your role, the more you understand that, you know, it's not only about the technical aspect, but you have to look at the organization, you know, the human component, the social aspect, the networking. And, you know, you grow from all angles. So that's basically it.
So that's why we asked you to be our host today, especially because of your expertise in architecture. We want to talk a bit more about microservices and architecture as well. So can you give us, for instance, a brief introduction of how you decided to get into architecture?
As I said, there was a point where I was leading a team. And then at that point, I had to decide. I mean, the truth is there was an opportunity. There was an opening in an architecture team. And actually, I have been working with architecture even in the role of team lead. The reason is that at the time, architecture, we used to work, I have to admit, in a waterfall approach. So what would happen is architecture would prepare the designs and then my team had to implement their design. Obviously, I was very critical of what they used to deliver. So I like to understand their reasoning. Sometimes I would post constructive criticism, you know, and I built a relationship basically with the architecture team at the time. And I felt that I really wanted to do their job, you know, like, and when the opportunity came about, I took it. And then I was lucky because the company eventually transitioned to a more agile approach. And so it wasn't only technical, we were trying also to do a culture shift. And it was really exciting. I mean, from a technical standpoint, I can tell you my first task was to standardize authorization and authentication for a particular brand. At the time, I'm talking 2012, OAuth 2.0 was really a fresh RFC. There weren't a lot of implementations of it. So I had to actually read the RFC, figure out how we can get to it. And, you know, I was happy because I think I'd look correctly. Eventually, OAuth became prominent as a authorization framework for APIs. And they had similar challenges. Like another one I can mention, I migrated code that was written in the late 90s, early 2000s to Git, you know, to a distributed version control system. So, I mean, I really enjoyed this set of challenges, you know, and every time I realized that it wasn't only about technologies, but you needed to take care of everyone that is impacted by that technology solution or problem. So I started to understand that you really need to look at the problem from multiple angles, understand what are the requirements of different stakeholders, and offer them solutions. And many times, not one solution. Like what I like always to stress out is we offer options, multiple options, and then you let the stakeholders decide. So I feel that the architect, to some extent, is a consultant, from if you see it from that angle.
This is a nice segue to the main topic that we wanted to discuss today on the show. So what you say is really interesting, because you need, as you get, you know, older and you mature as a software engineer, I guess you take into account many more aspects than just, you know, pure technology. You need to bring the whole organization, you know, with you, with the decisions that you make. So like related to this aspect, you know, we often talk about the eternal, I guess, war between microservices and monoliths and all other sort of architecture styles. So in this episode today, we wanted to, I guess, go deeper into, you know, the reasons why somebody should decide for microservices or not, and maybe keep this episode a little bit more concrete for our audience. So maybe let's explore, you know, what is good and what is bad about microservices, and why organizations should embrace microservices or not. I think you have a recent video on your channel where you have given an overview of microservices, but maybe just, you know, as if we were just chatting, you know, over a glass of wine, maybe. I know not many people talk over a glass of wine about microservices, but we might do that, you know.
I would prefer a beer.
Yeah, let's do a beer then. Let's do a beer.
Yeah.
But what do you think of microservices in your experience, and why would you consider them?
I mean, the issue in our industry with definitions is that it is very difficult to find a single definition. Because different people look at the same problem from different angles. So they give, you know, a different meaning to that word, microservices. What you need to do to understand how we got to this stage where we are today is you have to go a bit back and in the past, I think. I will mention, for instance, the concept of service-oriented architecture. You know, for a long period of time, I will admit that I had no idea what it was and how it was different from microservices. Because to some extent, I worked most of my professional career in the era of cloud native, microservices, you know, DevOps. So really, it was something distant that I could understand it's related, but I had no idea how. So I took some reading, sifting through blogs, videos, and stuff of the sort. And I think I built my own idea of how things evolved. And I think the problem is that you really need to go back in time. Like, my understanding is that, you know, like, if you think about, we talk about the monolith. The monolith exists even today. But in the late 80s and 90s, I think it was predominant. Possibly it was the most common form of architecture. And that had its advantages, but that obviously its disadvantages. And I think the disadvantages were more evident for large organizations that were building huge systems, what we call enterprise systems, right? And the challenges of monoliths, they are mostly under two categories. You know, you have the implementation issues, and then you have the operational ones. From an implementation perspective, it's obvious. You have this massive code base that possibly starts being well organized, well modularized, you know, and you think it's going to be maintainable. But The issue is when you try to scale the number of people working on it, it starts becoming very difficult to govern the way the code is structured, because new team, new people have different ideas. And that's how you get to spaghetti code, right? Which somehow it's, you know, it's the title of this podcast. And the problem with spaghetti code is, I mean,
it wasn't scripted. I just want to say this wasn't scripted.
No. Like, I tell you, you said I'm comfortable, you know, on YouTube, on the videos, but I find those stressful because I'm a guy, like, I like to have a chat and you will have to stop me. So what I was saying is that, and I lost the thread, to be honest. So we were saying, spaghetti code.
Yeah.
Let's go back to spaghetti code. I mean, I like spaghetti, but the issue is that when you have them in code, they make it very difficult to maintain and extend the code. By maintain, I literally say, you have a bug. Where is it? You know, go and find it. And you want to fix the bug. If the code is so intertwined, it's all highly coupled. Coupling is the key. You will have to touch a huge portion of the code to fix even a minute bug. So that's the problem with spaghetti code. And that makes it difficult to extend it as well, to add new features on top. And that's a problem for developers, but most importantly for business, because it means that if I'm the business owner and I want a new feature, I need to, you know, budget 6 months of work rather than a week or 2 weeks. And then you have the operational side. If you treat your deployable, so you literally build the code base as one executable and put it on one or two, three servers, this thing will be huge. And again, imagine the 90s, where we didn't have the same computational power, you know, the same bandwidth capability. It was a huge process and it was very difficult to do it zero downtime. So you need to go offline. And many times the deployments would be done over the weekend. And that means people have to work over the weekend. And that's a pain, you know, that's a pain for the operators, you know, the system engineers, app services, however you want to call them. It's a problem for the clients because, you know, nowadays we live in the era of SLA 3 nines, 4 nines, 5 nines. In the past, that wasn't there. But the service-oriented architecture was the stepping stone into getting to that state. And to me, and I will say that whenever I talk, you know, to my colleagues, I say, if you want to, you know, to understand only one thing, not about development, about life. When a problem becomes too big, break it into smaller problems. And literally, the service-oriented architecture, it's all about that. The system grew too large to think about it. We can't manage. We need to split it down. And literally, that's what you do with the service-oriented architecture.
That's a bit like our ancestor Romans used to say, divide et impera, right?
Yes.
And but I have a question about this because, you know, as Alessandro was saying, there is always this this like fight between monoliths. And, you know, you put it well, saying in the past, you know, it was difficult to do zero downtime, et cetera, et cetera. But I think nowadays, even with the monolith, we have the ability for doing deploy with zero downtime with a monolithic architecture as well. Now, and the fact that we have a monolith does not necessarily imply that we need to have spaghetti code in it. You know, there is a very, very famous article by David Hanson, you know, the creator of Ruby on Rails. I never remember the second H, what stand for. But anyway, the thing is that you can build a majestic monolith, right? A monolith that is modularized and, the, you know, as you were saying, is highly cohesive and low coupled, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and still doing downtime. Because, you know, with microservices, we get other problems. You know, we get problem of observability, for instance, or how the data and the interaction flows between the different microservices. There is more complexity, and also it requires engineers to have more skills from different angles, like you were saying, the DevOps. So my question is, why it has to be so bad? I mean, why we should necessarily switch to microservices.
Yes. I mean, I will admit, and this, you know, stresses out a lot of people, I don't think there is a straight answer. And even I don't think it's always black or white. There are shades of gray. But let's try to, you know, put things to extremes. Like, literally, we have to choose. Are we going for a monolith or are we going for microservices? I belong to that set of people that believes that you should never go into the complexity of microservices if you don't really need to. And why? Because whatever you said, it belongs to, I just, you know, call them the complexities of a distributed system. Like a distributed system, it's something incredibly difficult to design, to implement, and to operate. So literally, you have challenges at three levels. It starts from designing. It's difficult at that stage. Then it moves into implementing it and then operating it. But if you tell me why would you go for this complexity, I'll keep it short. I think if you go on the net, you find a lot of reasoning around it. But to me, the two most important reasons are, the first one is you literally need independent deployability. So you need to be able to have different number of services that are developed and deployed independently from each other. Like you really need to have this need. And it can be there for different reasons. Sometimes are, you know, some people think that, and on this I will say upfront that I don't believe it's a valid reason. Many times people say, you know what, I have five teams and I want them to work in parallel. I need microservices. It's true that microservices will help you there, because if you think your system, I'm simplifying, has five independent microservices, each team can be responsible for that microservice. It has full control. You know, there is code ownership. They are empowered and they can get done and deliver, you know, hopefully with little interaction with other teams, if the system is designed well, which many times it's not, right? But I don't think that that's a valid reason, because as you said, you could do this with a monolith if you modularize well. And in fact, today you will see that you go on the net, you find definitions of a modulith. To stress out, this is not the traditional monolithic application that it's a spaghettata, you know, in Italian, spaghetti called, right? It's a more well-thought, well-structured monolith that has well-defined modules. And nowadays you find a lot of solutions that help you there. Back in the past, the problem is that, you know, at the end of the day, you modules work under the idea that you do information hiding. You have an interface and you expose that interface to the public, and the implementation can change however you wish, right? Without impacting the clients. But when it's a monolith, it's one code base. So if you have a rogue developer, he can literally skip over the interface and point to the implementation. And the modularization there, it's gone out of the window. But I was saying, today you find software. So there are frameworks. I will mention, you have Spring, which is a very popular framework in the Java ecosystem. You have Spring Modulith. Or you could use also ArcUnit. And those would be all pieces of software that make sure that you stick into the boundaries defined by your module, and that you're not, you know, jumping over and pointing straight to an implementation or pointing to a service you're not supposed to invoke. So you have some help there. And that means, going back to your question, I don't think that's a valid reason, because today we could build a monolith well modularized. So, and that leads me to the other two reasons, which are independent deployments, and the other would be data isolation. Independent deployments, I can give you what I think would be an example that I've seen in my life. Many times you get this scenario where, and I'm not going into separate services, it could be even the same service, you know, like, I don't know, I'm creating a wallet system for, I don't know, like Google Pay. You would have a scenario where the right portion of the system, it's much less stressed than the read portion in terms of load. Like I will put my card once and then I will use it 1,000 times, right? And even the details of the implementation are very different. When you're inserting a new card, there is a whole complicated process where you need to validate the card, you need to do a lot of reasoning. So the data flow might be very complex. When it comes to the retrieval side, literally in a wallet system, all you have is return the payment methods and return the transactions where you use those payment methods, and it's done. But that's the most used, that's the most stressed. So an example is, rather than building them as a single application, why not building them as two independent services that I can scale independently? I could have three services that are used to add new payment methods, and then I can have 100 dealing with, retrieving a transaction list. That's one of the examples where you can see immediately the value of having the services deployable independently. And the other one I would mention is the data isolation. You don't have only a problem. We talk about spaghetti code. What about the data? And the data is critical for the organization to function. And as it becomes very difficult to think about a domain model, when it grows too large, it gets even more difficult to maintain the data, make sure that the data is not corrupted, make sure that you're not losing data at any point in time. So it starts becoming, and let me add something, yes, you might have also data size problems. Like the data is big in terms of its terabytes, petabytes, I don't know. And that forces you to split it. To be fair, in a monolithic application, if you wanted, you could use sharding techniques, so you could still have one data source but split in shards. But the truth is, development teams find much more easy to say, let's think about transaction processing, let's think about product inventory, let's think about, logistics as independent domains. Let's have one data store for them. We make it as strictly consistent, and the rest, it's a third party concern.
But actually, let me ask you one thing, because about this is true what you say, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, right? So as a manager, I always say, okay, we have a single data source that is growing. At one point, we have to break it down, and we can either break it down in shards, as you said. At the end of the day, you logically, you still have logically a single data source, but you split it physically in multiple locations, or you can do, more of a kind of a scaling in the services, so where you split it logically as well. But this kind of split, it brings a lot of cost from infrastructure point of view as well, right? So if you think about the financial part, microservices also come with higher costs to operate them. It's very, very difficult sometimes to decide. And of course, as you said, some other times you may just need to do it and there is no other way around it, right? But why someone should decide to not only go into the complexity of the system itself, as you said before, as you well explained before, but also the complexity and the burden from a financial point of view. So sometimes it looks like a lose-lose situation.
I think, it is very difficult. And I believe that you always have to look at the context and the type of application you need to deliver. Because I think there are scenarios where it's obviously clear that you cannot think as the system as one deployable or one source code base. But I think an aspect we're not putting into the picture, it's also time to market. I believe that if you do microservices right, you will get to market quickly. That's my personal belief. And then that would justify possibly the additional cost of infrastructure. Because the thing is this, and you know, I'm going to go back again in history to understand why I believe that microservices are superior from that point of view. If you look at the early implementation of service-oriented architecture, they had understood that they had to split the system into services. And they had also understood that they need to have the system communicate over the network through a common language. But the truth is that the biggest challenge that at the time was integration between the services. It was becoming very complicated. And then you had people that came out with infrastructural services and the famous or infamous enterprise service bus. And what you ended up having? You ended up having all this number of services that suppose they are, you know, they are distributed from a logical perspective, but they all punch in the same piece of infrastructure, which is highly centralized and represents also a single point of failure, right? So you had this, there was so much stress about reuse that they ended up building systems that they were in the end slow, you know, they wouldn't perform well. And there was this, many times they would be locked in because you wouldn't build your own ESB. You would go and buy a ready-made ESB. Because obviously commercial companies saw the gap and filled it. And they thought, and what usually, you get the same advert with the cloud. Stop thinking about, you know, deployments, virtual machines. We think about that. All you need to do is code your business logic and you're done. And in the end, that's never true. It's always a trade-off. But I think microservices, when done right, they allow you to parallelize development. And then from an operational perspective, you also stop, you don't have single points of failures. Like you, it's like, rather than putting all your eggs in one basket, you distribute them around. And if the system is well designed, you end up in a scenario where if a portion of the system goes offline, not your entire system is offline. And this ties also with the, because I mentioned timelines, but there is also, to me, another important concept is that it's much easier to some extent to stick to certain SLAs, like when the SLA is very, very demanding, I don't know, 4 nines, 5 nines, I don't know. Literally, it's a matter of distributing risk. Because if you put everything in one location and that thing fails, all right, you might solve it with redundancy. But there are, and you need also to see it in the context, I think, of how large is your system, how many domains it spans through, right? If it's large enough that I would say, all right, if I have an outage on this particular piece of critical infrastructure, all that's going down from a client perspective is functionality A. Maybe the payment system is down, but the rest of the system, it's up, alive, and stable.
Well, I was just reflecting on what you said, which is, you know, when microservices are done right, they help you go to market, you know, faster. Mm-hmm. But I have some thoughts on that because, like, I think if you want to go with a microservices architecture from the beginning, you need to resolve for many non-functional aspects that usually come a little easier in a monolith. Like, for example, you need to decide how you're going to handle, you know, cross services, transactions, you know, orchestration. You're going to need to decide how you're going to deploy all those services and what deployment model you want to follow. And you're going to have a pretty solid idea on how you want to observe all those services and instrument them versus maybe what happens with a monolith when some of these decisions are almost made for you automatically. And it might not be the right decision, you know, for you, but at least they help you, you know, go to market without having to spend too much time on these non-functional aspects. And then you can really make a decision informed by whether your software is getting used as you were expecting it to be in production or not. Maybe that's my own reflection.
No, I totally agree with you. But, and you know, I'm digesting what you said, but one word that was coming into mind based on what you were saying, it's flexibility. It's true. It's much easier to start with a monolith, but the end, it will serve you well because, you know, you don't have to do certain decisions and you don't need to have a certain platform where you run the system. All you need is to deploy it somewhere and it makes things easier. The problem is, and you will see, for some organization, this model will serve forever. So it's good. But then you see that a lot of popular organizations started with a monolith, but then there was a point in time it was not scaling for their particular use case.
Yes.
And they had to migrate to a microservices architecture. So if you tell me today, with the knowledge we have, with the, you know, we have the cloud native stack, you know, we have so many hyperscalers there from where to choose. If I would identify day one that there is potential for my system to need those scalability requirements, to need flexibility to add a large number of teams, and I have a whiteboard, why would I use the monolith from the beginning when I know I will be in that situation? And the problem is the transition from a monolith to a microservice is not trivial.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. You know, so if you can see from the beginning that you're going to end up in that scenario where the monolith will hinder your growth because you're dealing with a complex system that has so many moving parts, so many products involved, that it's literally difficult to imagine it as a single application, might as well you start from the design phase thinking it that way, you know, like I want to apply SOA principles, microservices. And then, as I said, it's, to me, it's not black or white. Like, you don't need to go full in because you will find books that tell you go serverless. So literally, we're not talking about microservices. We're talking of thinking about your system in terms of individual functions. I'm not telling you go there, but plan ahead for your system to be splittable in a number of independent subdomains. And even if you have a monolith, you have to do that.
Yes, absolutely.
So I mean, to me, literally, it's all about, and if you've seen my videos, I push this concept very much. I hear people telling me domain-driven design is dead. And it makes me laugh because possibly people do not know what domain-driven design is and do not apply it in a formal way because they don't know it well. But the actual act of seeing the requirements and trying to understand how you translate them in code, you're doing domain-driven design. You're understanding the domain of your application, so what it's supposed to deliver, and you're trying it to model it into something that you can turn into code. And I think that step you need to do it, and that step will tell you if you can slot your app as a monolith or if it's better to split certain. I can give you a concrete example. Like the last system I built, it's a product in an infrastructure as a service provider, right? Like, and you will see how obvious it is that doesn't make sense to have a monolith here, because my biggest challenge is where I have the challenge of interacting with the physical infrastructure. So I need to be able to configure a bare metal server, right? So I need to go low level. I need to be able to interact with the switch, the network switch, so I can do network segregation. And that to me, it's one domain, automation. And then I have the problem is that I need to monitor the usage of the resources. If a client buys a server, I need to know for how long used it so that I can charge it. Those domains, it's much easier to think about them as completely independent. And this, it's a principle that comes from service-oriented architecture. And when you work with that mechanism, you say, all right, billing or monitoring usage and rating that usage, so giving it a cost, it's a system on its own. I won't build it for my particular product. I will build it for the enterprise. I will go to the enterprise and tell them, listen, we need the rating system. And you can buy it, you can build it, but we do it only once. And it will serve not only my new infrastructure as a service product, but it can serve other product lines. And that's how you start even, because we were talking about money. Here now we start saving money, because if you had individual teams thinking about their system delivery, application delivery as a monolith, that and they just develop it in isolation, they wouldn't spot reuse. And they would rebuild the same thing over and over. I can give you another concrete example. I told you my first task was standardizing authentication and authorization. Why? Because we had so many different systems with different authentication and authorization standards applied. Some were custom in-house. So we needed standardization. We needed to have, because you're saving some cost. I want a new product, and as part of the product, I need to re-implement the identity layer. No, I implement the identity layer once. And that's, it's obvious, a win that you can have only if you are aware of SOA. Without SOA, this wasn't happening. I mean, possibly there were, and what I want to say is, in software, it's never like someone woke up a morning and said, let's do SOA. The truth is there were teams that were smart enough that even in the era of monoliths, they knew, this service, I will really need it, so I centralize it here so that it can be reused. But the truth is that then this usually they are, you know, innovators, people that can look ahead. But then to bring with you all the market, you need someone that formalizes the framework, formalizes the process, and also does some evangelization.
So one thing I always say, and you know, people ask me, especially people, of course, that are less familiar with technologies and heard about microservices, or they, you know, maybe they have some exposure to technology, say, well, when should we move to microservices? I think most of the answer, and actually, I was in a situation a few weeks ago where I've been asked a lot of questions. And I realized at the end of the conversation that a lot of answer I was giving was starting with depends. So, you know, my counterpart was not happy, obviously, with those type of answer. But the reality was always like, well, everything you choose, yeah, it depends on the context. It depends on the situation. It depends on what you're trying to achieve. It depends how fast you want to go. It depends on all those things. Then there's no recipe. And this is in life, yeah, honestly. It's not just in our context. So in IT. So what do you think about this? I mean, how do you reconcile when people ask you, make you those questions, and you need to often tell them how it depends?
So I usually answer by selling myself and by selling architecture. And I will explain why. So as you said, and even when you ask me first time, like looking back, I'm not happy of the answer I gave you. And the truth is that it's very difficult to give a one-liner answer. You use microservices when this happens. As you said, it depends. But what I always tell people is that that's exactly the role of architecture. It doesn't need to be an architect. I want to highlight when I talk about architecture, for me, architecture can be done by any engineer in the company. But by architecture, what I mean is that you need to go through that process where you do requirements elicitation, so you understand what you're supposed to deliver. And the next step, and that's where architecture comes in, is you create a set of options that allow your system to remain flexible over time. Like, you never want to choose an option that boxes you, like, I'm choosing this, I have to stick with this solution for the next 10 years. You need to find a technical solution that allows you to evolve over time. And that means that when you look at it, about it, it's not anymore about monolith versus microservice, but it's literally about adopting a style that can evolve in every direction, because you could literally figure out that it's better for you to start as a monolith. But we need to modularize that monolith day one. We need to have those modules well delimited, so that if one day, all of a sudden, I realize that that deployment strategy is not scaling for me, I take that module and I make it a microservice. So it's not literally about choosing between the two. It's about being able to move between the two, because you can have the opposite approach. If you go for serverless, where all your system is functioning, good luck to you figuring out that some stuff, it's so cohesive, so it works, it's so intertwined that it belongs to the same service and you need to go back. So someone who's stepping into microservices would still design the system in a way that one day, if need be, these two services, I can merge them in one deployable. Because I can already spot there is some cohesion, but at this stage I want to keep them split or I keep them together. So literally, and I know that it sounds like I want to sell domain-driven design, you need to understand your domain. And you need, to me, there cannot be, if your system is complex enough that it's dealing with a lot of different problems, it's not possible that you can think of it as a single domain. You need to identify your subdomains. What is it? Payments, automation, invoicing, auditing. Those things, you need to see them day one. If you see them day one, I think it matters less whether you're going with a monolith or a microservice. My fear is that, as you said, monolith is way easier. So the truth is, some people don't go to the monolith because they are doing this reasoning. Some reason they are just getting started with coding. And then we see. And that's the biggest issue, because then fast forward a few years ahead, and you will have trouble. And you will have to rewrite the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so we're nearing the end of this episode. And I think, as it's normal with this type of conversation, you know, it's never easy to give, you know, a straight answer. You know, you have to go with microservices or not. But I think a few very important things that you covered, Marco, I think they should stick. We should stick with them whenever we, you know, we work with technology. And I think those are, you know, we are at the moment in an era where, you know, infrastructure is very cheap and like scalable and efficient infrastructure is very cheap to, you know, to get. So we should, as engineers, we should really get familiar with the most recent technologies that, you know, enable scalable and efficient infrastructure to build applications that have these characteristics, you know, from the get-go, so that we can face, you know, changing demands, changing markets and changing contexts, and make our software much more adaptable to changing conditions. I think this is one of the most important things that I learned from you today. And sometimes, you know, we might pick monoliths as a default answer just because we're more comfortable with them, but maybe we should get comfortable with whatever, you know, modern days, you know, give us in terms of technology choices. And another important aspect, though much more important in my opinion, is that no matter the architecture style you go with, you really need to be deliberate about the domains you're serving with your software, because if you don't understand the domains you're solving problems for, you know, it doesn't matter what architecture style you're gonna pick, you're always gonna have a hard time, you know, building software around them. So you really need to be deliberate about the domains, but also keep an eye on them as your software evolves, as your software changes, and the needs of your customers and users change. So I think this is another strong key takeaway that we get from you, Marco, today. As I said, we're closing now the episode, but I would love if you, Marco, could give our audience a few sort of resources, where to find you, and maybe even other sort of resources that you think people should keep an eye on to keep, you know, up to speed about technology in general?
I mean, for what concerns where to find me, you know, like just at my website or my YouTube channel, so marcolenzo.eu or Marco Lenzo YouTube channel, you know. And when it comes to the resources, I mean, there is so much. I will just give you some that I follow. Like obviously I follow the technology radar by what's their name? Now it's not coming to mind. ThoughtWorks, right?
Yeah.
So that's very important. But in reality, what I do is, you know that I told you at the beginning, I was lucky to have very good mentors. I really like to get inspired by leaders in our industry. So I follow Fowler, Robert Martin, Dave Farley, Kelsey Hightower, and they could, you know, increase that list. Those are a source of information, and I love these people because they share. They literally have that community spirit of evangelizing. You know, like they don't keep their ideas for themselves. So start getting familiar with who are the key players in our industry, the people that we need to look up to, and, you know, subscribe to their social accounts, and you would have a wealth of information, blog posts and whatever you want. I mean, that those are just an example, but I think that the best ideas came always from these guys. And I like to read, and that's how I discovered. Actually, I forgot one of my favorite, which is Gregor Hope, you know? So that's another key player in the industry. That's my advice, you know? Look up to, you know, people you can figure out, you know, they really contributed to our profession in a positive way.
Thank you so much, Marco. Really, really insightful, and really happy to have you here on the show with us today.
Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.